Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. Start out with some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the Huffington Post, huffingtonpost.com, it's entitled The Bailout Watchdog, Obama Foreclosure Plan Inadequate, New Direction Needed. Ed Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard law professor turned crusader for Main Street and the middle class, to the growing list of experts calling for the Obama administration to scrap its failed foreclosure prevention plan in favor of one that would actually help troubled homeowners keep their homes. The Congressional Oversight Panel that Warren heads issued a new report last week concluding that the government's $7 billion bailout program did in fact help stabilize the financial system, but has largely failed to boost lending or prevent foreclosures. In a conference call with reporters last week, Warren spelled out just how dramatically the administration's signature foreclosure effort, called the Home Affordable Modification Program, has fallen short. Nationwide, only 10,187 homeowners have received permanent mortgage modifications. That's only 4.7% of those enrolled in three-month trial plans. In October, Herbert M. Allison Jr., the Treasury Department's Assistant Secretary for Financial Stability, told the panel that Treasury has internally forecast that up to 75% of trial modifications would achieve permanent status. Of the 79 mortgage services enrolled in the program, only 10 have received payment for successfully modifying loans on a permanent basis. They earned $2.3 million for their efforts. By contrast, the administration has set aside $50 billion in bailout money for modifications on mortgages not owned by government-backed mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The data is through the end of October. The administration launched its foreclosure prevention drive in March. HAMP was supposed to help 3 to 4 million homeowners avoid foreclosure by modifying their mortgages, enabling them to make lower monthly payments. But with 10% unemployment, a 26-year high, mounting foreclosures, and as many as one-third of all homeowners with a mortgage currently owing more on the mortgage than the underlying property is worth, the program simply isn't working, Professor Warren said. The program that Treasury has designed does not have the scope, the scale, or the permanence needed to deal with the foreclosure problem, she continued. It's a stinging indictment of a program launched to great fanfare not even a year ago, as President Obama sought to help aggrieved homeowners on Main Street who had watched for months as massive infusions of taxpayer dollars went to Wall Street instead. Even though the Treasury Department every month touts the numbers of homeowners signed up for trial plans as a sign of progress, Warren's panel notes in its report that monthly foreclosures still far outpace the number of new trial modifications. The panel emphasizes that it is the number of foreclosures averted, not the number of trial modifications offered or even trial modifications commenced, that is the proper metric for evaluating HAMP, the report reads. As currently structured, HAMP appears capable of preventing only a fraction of foreclosures. By contrast to the program's target of 3 or 4 million homeowners helped, the report notes projections for foreclosure range from 8.1 million over the next 4 years to as high as 13 million over the next 5+ years. So even if the Treasury actually hit its targets, Warren said, the program would still only be dealing with a third of projected foreclosures. That's not adequate, she said. A major source of the panel's frustration is the program's failure to adequately address the problems of unemployed homeowners and those with negative equity. Those without a job typically don't have enough income to qualify for the program. And what homeowners who owe more on their houses than they are worth really need is to have their total debt reduced. But HAMP doesn't provide any incentive to lenders to reduce principal. So underwater homeowners might see their interest rates reduced through HAMP, but if their principal remains unchanged, they are at increased risk of defaulting again. No one is helped by a program that kicks foreclosures down the line, Warren said. The panel's report suggests that Treasury, like the FDIC is doing, should consider principal reductions. As an update, the Treasury released a statement Wednesday morning in response to the panel's report. It reads, Congress enacted the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008, 1 year ago in the face of the most severe financial crises in modern history. That decision averted a catastrophic collapse and, by every measure, TARP has succeeded in achieving its primary goal of economic stabilization. Confidence in our financial system has improved, access to credit is increasing, and the economy is growing. Moreover, the government is exiting from its emergency financial policies, and taxpayers are being repaid. Indeed, the ultimate cost of those policies is likely to be significantly lower than previously expected. Still, challenges to economic recovery remain. Unemployment and foreclosure rates remain high, while access to credit for small businesses is limited. For this reason, the focus of TARP now is on responsible homeowners and small businesses. Improvement in these areas will take some time, and our job is not done. We continue to work collaboratively with all oversight bodies to advance our shared goals of full financial recovery and ultimately a conclusion to TARP. And I'd like to end the news for this week with a quote from Paul Volcker, the former federal chairman. He said, "Has there been one financial leader to say this is really excessive? Wake up, gentlemen. Your response, I can only say, has been inadequate. Wake up, gentlemen. I wish someone would give me one shred of neutral evidence that financial innovation has led to economic growth. One shred of evidence. Is that a reflection of your financial innovation or just a reflection of what you're paid? You can innovate as much as you like, but do it within a structure that doesn't put the whole economy at risk." So that's Paul Volcker, former federal chairman. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And continuing in the second segment of the show, I have been discussing the two-income trap, why middle-class mothers and fathers are going broke, with some surprising solutions that will change our children's future. This is a textbook, essentially for this program, by Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi. Last week I was talking about the cost of colleges for families now, and how this actually has been a kind of a setup by the colleges themselves, despite what most middle-class people think. Colleges have become more and more expensive over the last few decades, including state-run universities. And because as Americans, we hold the need for a college education as essential for success for young people in the economy, getting into college has become more of a challenge and also much more expensive. As I said, with more applications flooding admissions offices every year, colleges are really in a catbird seat, free to increase the price of admissions with relative impunity. Parents do complain, as do students, but since nearly two-thirds of parents view a degree for their child as absolutely essential, universities can safely assume that families will find a way to pay. And that is precisely what has happened. After we adjust for inflation, in-state tuition and fees at the average state university has nearly doubled in less than 25 years. So putting that in a perspective, the price of college has grown twice as fast as the average professor's salary, three times faster than the cost of food, and eight times faster than the cost of electricity. Tuition, room, and board now cost more than $8,600 a year at the average public university. To pay these fees, the average family in the United States has to commit 17% of its total pre-tax income to this one expense. A private education is even more costly. And the curious reality is that oftentimes people make good money, although they are not quote-unquote rich, yet they are then in a category where they don't qualify for financial aid. So the bottom line is that they're going to spend $100,000 out of their own pockets for each child to go to college at a private institution. Now, we all feel generally that it is absolutely essential that university administrators keep tuition from rising, general public opinion, but the costs continue to spiral upward anyway. The university officials typically blame tuition hikes on inevitable consequences of rising costs, the high cost of keeping up with scientific discoveries, the need to provide technology resources for students and faculty, and the growth of financial aid, which are all valuable endeavors. So Professor Warren responds by some examples. She says the American Association of University Professors blames spiraling administrative costs, which grew by 60% between 1980 and 1997. The people running the show are
making or
spending more. The American Council on Education points to student expectations for a high level and wide variety of services, including, among other things, much better food services. Another study shows that the more prestigious colleges have decreased the teaching loads of their undergraduate professors, giving them more time for research and other pursuits. And then the last major cost that I discussed last week was sports. It turns out that even in winning years, only a few big programs break even to sell out crowds and television deals. For most colleges, the cost to field teams in every sport must come out of the general budget. One example Professor Warren gave was basketball powerhouse Duke University, where it takes $4 million to $5 million out of the university's general revenues to pump into the athletic budget each year. Another example was Columbia University, which allocates and redirects $7 million a year of its general revenue to make up the shortfall in athletics. Most universities are spending more every year, and the deficits are getting larger. According to the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the overwhelming majority of colleges lose money on their sports programs. During the 1990s, the average deficit grew by more than 50% for all but the largest universities. So these are massive costs. And Professor Warren points out these expenditures not because
she is
contrary to college sports programs. Most of us are somewhat diehard about sports and do recognize the ancillary benefits that come to the athletes, the fans, and the institution from sports programs. But the point is that there is a myth that college costs are like helium balloons that inevitably rise by the immutable laws of nature, which is what we're sold by the college administrations. Colleges are charging more not because they must, but because they can. Also, like parents, institutions of higher learning have entered into a bidding war of their own. Not the war to provide the best value to families, but the war to produce the best research, win the most basketball games, win the most football games here in Iowa, and even to serve the best food to induce students to choose their institution. Professor Warren points out that, according to the Chronicle of Higher Education, virtually every university in America aspires to make it into the top 50 or the top 20 or the top 10, and that's not percent. As a result, colleges have engaged in an arms race of expenditures triggered by the pursuit of prestige. And who's stuck paying the bill? Parents, mostly middle-class parents. In the absence of rising demand, this kind of arms race of prestige just wouldn't have been possible. If Americans had not come to view a college degree as equivalent to an admission ticket to good jobs and a middle-class lifestyle, then demand for a university slot would have been much less intense. Parents would have been much freer to shop for a college on the basis of price or to forego higher education altogether if the price seemed too high. The result would have been that all but the most elite universities would have felt a lot of pressure to keep costs down. Colleges might have been forced to make some painful cuts, but university tuition would have behaved more like any other rational marketplace in which supply and demand are balanced and price holds relatively steady. So we looked at whether it was time for a tuition freeze. In this discussion, whenever college costs are brought up, conservative policymakers typically focus on making more loans available to families, more debt.
As a
bankruptcy attorney, I can tell you that this may not really be a solution. In 2001, over 5 million students had borrowed $34 billion in federal student loans, more than triple the amount borrowed just 10 years
earlier.
And of course, that was almost 10 years ago, and these numbers are going up. And back then, looking at students borrowing from private lenders, we see it grew even faster, increasing fivefold in just 6 years. And as an aside, these loans have much higher interest rates and they're often adjustable interest rates. As I ended up last week, every year more than 1 million families take out a second mortgage on their homes just to pay for educational expenses. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So I was just mentioning how every year more than 1 million families take out a second mortgage on their homes just to pay for educational expenses. And what many people don't realize is that much of the foreclosure dilemma that America is involved in right now relates to refinancing the mortgage on the home. A very large percentage, I've seen numbers up to 80% of the foreclosure numbers, isn't on a first-time purchase of a house, but it's on the concept that a person, a family, has equity in their home after owning it and paying for so many years, And that equity is like a savings account, a concept that has been marketed by the banks. It was brought out that families should be using this money for a variety of things, including college educations. And many, many of the foreclosures that are happening now were for these kinds of loans against the equity, with the new twists of mortgage terms from fixed to adjustable rate, with all these option kinds of deals and major changes in the basics of mortgages. Families discovered that their $500 a month mortgage payment suddenly became $1,000 a month, and then $1,200 a month, and then impossible to pay. So their home is up for foreclosure, although they were borrowing money against the equity to send their child to school. Borrowing does not reduce the cost, certainly not for the mortgage, but not for college either. It simply means that families can pay and pay and pay some more. And as what we've seen lately, it also means that the family can lose their house. So at what point do we come to the conclusions that family have taken on all the debt they can handle? The debt load tripled in the 90s and obviously has gone up tremendously in the first decade of the new millennium. As Professor Warren states so succinctly, offering these families more debt is like throwing rocks to a drowning man. It won't help. Now, liberals, for their part, regularly call on taxpayers to foot more of the bill for education. But taxpayers generally are paying more. Over the past two decades, states increased per pupil appropriations to public universities by 13% adjusted for inflation. So the taxpayers were paying. How much more are taxpayers supposed to pay? Are state governments supposed to write a blank check for higher education, allowing universities to increase costs with abandon? I don't think so. College administrators point out that a 13% increase in public funding fell far short of the 41% growth in university expenditures, which is why they were forced to raise the tuition so much. Well, that may be true, but that simply says we're spending more than the state will give us, so we pass the cost on to the families. This is not really a very sound endorsement of the frugality of the current system. Not at all. When we look at it, the more taxes approach suffers from the same problem the more debt approach suffers. It gives colleges more money to spend without any attempt to control the spiraling costs. As Professor Warren is so good at suggesting, perhaps it's time to shake things up with a hold on price increases. A multi-year freeze on tuition at all state universities would really prompt an intensive discussion of higher education priorities and some hard choices. Do they all want to offer expensive sports programs? Should some colleges concentrate on science and engineering, while others focus on liberal arts? Should universities be asked to educate more students in exchange for additional tax dollars? According to Professor Warren, this approach would certainly hit the supply and demand problem right between the eyes. If all state-supported universities were committed to stopping tuition increases, the effects would reverberate throughout the educational system. Many public colleges might rededicate themselves to serving their local communities, dropping out of the arms race for ephemeral national prestige. The pressure would be on private colleges to follow suit, lest the gap between private and public tuitions grew even larger. The upward spiral of tuition and the resulting "it's not our fault, everyone else is doing it" type of mentality would receive a serious thumping. Colleges and universities are like any other organism in the desire for survival and growth. Their leaders are true believers in the research and scholarly missions of their schools and their desire for excellence, however it is measured among universities, is genuine. It is no wonder that they can always justify their rising costs and why they need every penny that comes their way, and always more. There can always be more research, more athletic fields, more books for the library. To be sure, the issues are complex, and a spending freeze might force some universities to make some very tough choices. In the long run, however, it would refocus public universities on their mission, providing an education for all qualified members of the public, not just those who can come up with $10,000 or $20,000 each year.
The cost of college education has had an unbelievably large impact on middle-class families. The desire to send the children to school is so great that, as we just discussed, it actually created this borrowing against the equity of the house, for example, and many families have put their home at risk due to those kinds of mortgages or lost their home as the banks walked away with all of the money. Moreover, we've seen as bankruptcy attorneys a huge problem because many clients across the country have immense student loan debt. Sometimes I see what's owed and I cannot even believe it. Former students owing hundreds of thousands of dollars for their education, often co-signed by their parents, and those students in jobs that, frankly, will never gain them enough income to pay off that debt, and also facing the reality that student loan debt is not dischargeable in bankruptcy for the most part, unless there is, in practical terms, the inability to make any money for the rest of one's life, known as a hardship discharge, which is very rare. We want young people to go to college to get a good education and, as a result, to improve their lives. But we've gotten to the point where education is mostly a conduit for the desire to make more money, to have a better job, to have more success in the financial world. But this actually has created a downward spiral in the value, purpose, and benefit of education because of what it does financially to middle-class families. State institutions really need to reconsider some of the basic purposes of what they're doing and what the true mission is of education. Professor Warren's suggestion of a tuition freeze is really a wonderful challenge to the educational system, one that we should all take very seriously if we are going to lift ourselves out of the debt problem, which is, as we see in the media every day, starting to infiltrate in almost every family's life in some tangible and substantial way. And we will continue more next week with the family car in relationship to the two-income trap. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.